Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
All right, and welcome back to Behind the Knife, our mock oral boards scenarios this week. Last week, you heard our great review by Dr. Blatnick going over just kind of the ins and outs and tips and tricks on how to dominate the oral boards. And this week, he's nice enough to come back with us and put Jason and I through a couple of scenarios just so you guys can get a gist of how to do it wrong. Jason, welcome.
Glad to be here. Let's do it.
And Dr. Blatnick, thank you again.
Happy to be a part of it. I think what we're going to try and do is set it up so in the real boards, you're going to do four cases in a half an hour, so it's going to be pretty fast. Probably won't go quite as fast today. I think what we'll do is we'll kind of run two scenarios for each of you. We'll kind of do one and then jump right into the next one, similar to the board style. And then we'll take a little break, kind of debrief, go a little bit about management, what you could have done differently, and some of the technique as to how you guys answer the questions. And then we'll move on and do another two, if that sounds all right.
That sounds perfect.
So as a little bit of a background, so when you guys actually get to the boards and get your real day, you know, they give you an assignment. It tells you the three rooms that you're going to be in. It'll tell you who the six examiners that you will be with, so you can kind of take a look at everybody. The goal is to make it so you don't have any sort of conflict with any of the examiners that you will be with. So you should never have worked with anybody or done any kind of research with anybody or anything like that. And so you'll know ahead of time kind of who you're with. And when your time comes, you'll kind of go to your first room and you'll wait outside the door. And when they're ready for you, they'll open the door and they'll say, come on in. And they'll have you take a seat. They'll give you about a 30-second kind of overview as to what they're going to do and how it's going to go. And then the first examiner will ask you the first scenario. Now, on the real boards, there's two examiners, and they'll go back and forth. So the first examiner will ask one question, the second one will ask the second, the first one will ask the third, and then the second one will ask the fourth question and go back and forth. For the most part, the examiner's only going to, the examiner that asks the question is the only one that's going to interact with you for that scenario. So if the examiner number one does question number one, all of the information and stuff on question number one in general is going to come from examiner number one. Examiner number two will be scoring you and grading you and all that stuff as well, but most of the interaction is going to come from the first examiner. And they'll go through the four scenarios, and at the end they'll say thank you, and you'll get up and you'll walk to your next room and you'll wait outside the door, and that room will open and you'll go back in and start it all over again. And before you know it, that hour and a half will be over. And you can finally take a breath and go have a drink.
And I just want to give a little disclaimer. None of the mock oral cases we're doing today are content of the American Board of Surgery. These were all made up by Dr. Blatnick on his own, and we are not using any of their material, and we have actually cleared this with the American Board of Surgery prior to doing this podcast.
And Kevin and I have not been prompted in it. Kevin and I have not been prompted in any way as to what these scenarios are, so this should be an authentic representation.
I think that'll be pretty obvious.
Yep. I spent a couple hours this weekend coming up with some scenarios for you guys. Actually, I think in looking at them, none of them are even in the same kind of category of what I had on my real board, so we'll be from scratch. We'll see how everybody does, and we'll go from there.
Awesome.
All right, so who's up first?
That'll be me, Jason.
All right, let me get a clock ready so we can kind of keep track of the time. All right, Jason, so your first scenario is going to be a 65-year-old female. She presents to your office as an outpatient setting with a one-year history of vague epigastric abdominal pain, some mild reflux symptoms associated with nausea, and what she reports is some mild discomfort when she swallows. She was started on a PPI by her primary care physician a couple months ago with just some mild improvement of her symptoms. She reports that she's lost 10 pounds over the last 6 months.
Okay, so I would start with the history and physical. The things I would focus on first would be things that would increase her risk of any malignancies. So I would ask her about a history of smoking, a history of alcohol use, a family history of any cancer, specifically gastric or esophageal cancers. the onset or how long your symptoms have been going on, if it's both solids and liquids. You said she's lost some weight. And a history of any, you know, prior abdominal surgeries.
So she does not smoke. She has social alcohol, enjoys a glass of wine a couple times a week. Her family history is negative for any kind of malignancy. Her dysphagia, she said just sometimes if she eats a big meal, she feels like some food kind of gets stuck and has a little discomfort, but no issues with liquids or anything like that. The weight loss was 10 pounds over the last 6 months, as mentioned, and she's symptoms she can kind of think go back for 1 year now.
Okay. From there, I would probably move very quickly to obtaining some imaging. So I would start with upper GI swallow study with fluoroscopy.
So you get your upper GI with fluoroscopy. It shows a moderate size, what looks like a hiatal hernia. The contrast passed through into the stomach and down into the small intestines, but it looks like it's about a third of the stomach is up in the chest.
Okay, so now I'm thinking she has a third of the stomach. So she has a paraesophageal hernia. So this is now... from here, I would start risk stratifying her for it's symptomatic. It's a it's a paraesophageal hernia with part of the stomach up there. So if she's a good surgical candidate, it would need to be repaired. So I would start risk stratifying her, asking her about any her functional status, any cardiac, cardiopulmonary problems, to see if she needs any further risk stratification before proceeding with repair.
So you partner up with your anesthesia providers. They do a full preoperative assessment. She checks out. She has no issues cardiac or pulmonary-wise that would prevent her from having surgery.
Okay, and there was no. Let's see. Has she ever had an upper endoscopy?
She has not. Would you like one?
Yes.
Okay. So, are you going to do that yourself or are you going to have your gastroenterologist do that?
I would do that myself.
Okay. So, you elect to do your EGD to kind of evaluate things. And what are you looking for specifically?
Well, I'd be looking, before I proceed with surgery, she has a history of dysphagia. I want to make sure that her history is from her paraesophageal hernia. There's no masses. There's no nothing that would preclude me from proceeding with her repair.
Okay. So you do your EGD. Just kind of identify and confirm what looks like the type 3 paraesophageal hernia. You find no other masses or gross abnormalities. You can pass your scope down through the stomach into the duodenum without any difficulties, and on retroflex view, you do not appreciate any other masses at the GE junction.
Okay, so at this point, I think she's been she's a good surgical candidate. I would proceed with a laparoscopic paraesophageal hernia repair.
Okay, kind of tell me how you would do that.
Perform it laparoscopically. So I placed my ports, one in the epigastrium, a few in the left upper quadrant loop, a few in the right upper quadrant, in the sub-xiphoid region. A sub-costal area triangulating towards the esophagus. I would identifying or dissecting, I would use an NCL device or an energy device and dissect out and visualize both the left and the right crus at the esophagus. I would with gentle traction, I would try and reduce my paraesophageal hernia. I would completely excise the completely reduce the hernia sac and perform a mediastinal mobilization of the esophagus in order to comfortably bring the GE junction down below the diaphragm. Once this is done, it appears like the GE junction is staying within the stomach without any tension being pulled back above, I would close I would reapproximate the crus using an interrupted absorbable suture over a bougie, large size bougie, a size, 50 bougie. I would then perform a full Nissen funduplication, 360 degree wrap.
Okay, so you do your funduplication. What's going to be your postoperative management?
So postoperatively, I would keep her in the hospital for at least a night. I would continue her. I would discontinue her PPI unless she had symptoms. I would keep her on a liquid diet for at least 1 week and a soft diet for approximately 3 weeks, and counsel her to avoid things like carbonated beverages and breads.
Okay, let's say on post-op day number one, you let her start some liquids and she reports that she can't get anything down. You just vomits it back up.
Oh, she's actually vomiting. So I would.
Yeah, everything she tries to drink, she coughs back up.
Okay. I would perform if on post-op day one, this is likely secondary to swelling from the surgery itself. If it persisted, I would be concerned that the wrap was too light or too tight, but I would give this a couple days for the swelling to go down and see if it resolves.
Okay, so post-op day number two, she has the same symptoms.
Okay, so I would obtain a repeat upper endoscopy or a repeat upper GI fluoroscopy study.
Okay, so you get your esophagram, and it shows that no contrast makes it through the GE junction of the stomach.
Okay. Well, you could. Well, what I would do first is I would give it a couple days to see if it got better. If it didn't get better, I would perform an upper endoscopy and potentially do a balloon dilation.
So, how long would you wait?
I would give it. Immediately postoperatively, I would give it a week or two, and then if that it doesn't resolve, I would perform an upper endoscopy and a balloon dilation.
Okay. Your next case is a 22-year-old female who presents to the emergency department. You're asked to come evaluate her there. She reports a one-day history of right lower quadrant abdominal pain, fevers, and nausea. She reports that the pain started periumbilical, moved to the right lower quadrant. She's otherwise healthy.
Okay, so 22-year female, right lower quadrant pain. High in my differential would be acute appendicitis or some GYN, ovarian cyst, ovarian torsion, those type of things. I would start with a history and physical, again, focusing on the onset of symptoms, any fevers, any history of similar complaints, any family history of things like Crohn's, ulcerative colitis, and any prior abdominal operations.
So she's not had any previous abdominal operations. She reports that she's been otherwise healthy. Her family history is negative for any type of other abnormalities. She is sexually active, but just had her period 3 weeks ago.
Okay, and on physical exam, you say she's tender in the right lower quadrant. Any signs of peritonitis?
So on physical exam, she has mild to moderate right lower quadrant tenderness, with maybe some mild voluntary guarding. She's got no other peritoneal signs.
Okay, so I would perform a laboratory workup to include a CBC, a basic metabolic panel, a set of LFTs, a urinalysis, and a pregnancy test.
On all those things, the CBC, it comes back with a white count of 15,000. Her pregnancy test is negative. Her UA is negative. And her basic metabolic panel is unremarkable, okay. As are her LFT.
Okay. I would obtain a CT scan with IV contrast.
Okay. So you get your CT scan with IV contrast. It shows thickened and dilated appendix with some periappendiceal stranding.
And any signs of perforation or... free air, free fluid.
There's no air. Yeah, there's no air around it. There's no evidence of any abscess or anything like that.
Okay. I would counsel her options, but I would recommend that she get a dose of IV antibiotics, either levoquinone flagyl or Zosyn or something similar in the emergency department, and we proceed to the operating room for laparoscopic appendectomy.
Okay. Okay. How would you do that?
So I would place a peri-umbilical port. In my own hands, I would do a Hassan entry. I would place two additional 5mm ports, one in the left lower quadrant, one in the suprapubic area. Prior to doing this, I would place a Foley catheter to reduce the risk of any bladder injury during this. Triangulated towards the right lower quadrant, I would identify the base of the appendix as it comes off the cecum. I would follow the tinea of the cecum to identify where the base of the appendix would be. Mobilize my appendix, create a window at the base. I would use a linear cutting laparoscopic stapler, typically a blue load for the base of the appendix, followed by a white load for the meso appendix. Place it in an endocatch retrieval bag. And suction any free fluid or inflammatory fluid from the pelvis, and then remove the appendix in the endocatch bag.
Okay, let's say you get your CT scan; it shows a similar thing, and you go and talk to the patient about needing an appendectomy, and mm-hmm. she asks you about non-operative management. She heard some things online about, mm-hmm. or read some things about non-operative management. What would you tell her?
I would tell her that it's certainly an option, given that I would say that there's a, I would quote her at approximately 25% failure rate over the next couple of years of either not responding to the antibiotics or having a recurrent bout of appendicitis. But that treatment with antibiotics alone is a viable option if you were willing to accept those risks.
Okay. So let's go back one more time. You get your CT scan. It now shows evidence of an abscess in the right lower quadrant. It measures approximately 4 by 4 centimeters.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do now?
I would give IV antibiotics in the emergency room. I would admit her to the hospital. I would talk to my interventional radiology colleagues about placing a percutaneous drain in that abscess and treating with drainage and antibiotics.
Okay, so you do that. You get a percutaneous drain in. It comes back with some purulent tile material, put her on some antibiotics. And over the next 3 to 4 days, she continues to improve. And she's getting ready. She's tolerating a diet now, and she's ready to go home and asking, what should she do next?
In that case, I would advise her that, again, there's a greater than 25% risk of recurrence of this, I would advise her to obtain an interval appendectomy. I would bring her back in 6 to 8 weeks for an interval appendectomy.
Okay. So let's go back and say instead of a 22-year-old female, it's now a 55-year-old female. What other things would you be concerned about?
I would be concerned about an undiagnosed malignancy. I would inquire as to history of prior colonoscopy, ensure she was up to date on her colorectal cancer screening.
Okay. Good job. How do you think you did?
Okay. I think I probably stumbled a little bit on the first one, probably before I wrapped, I should have done, got some, perhaps some esophageal manometry and those type of things. If I was planning on doing a wrap.
I agree. Yep. So let's go through it kind of step by step. So a couple things just kind of off the bat, the first scenario took us 9 minutes to get through. So, some scenarios you'll spend a little bit more time on, some you'll spend a little bit less time, but it was 9 minutes for us to get through the first scenario. And if you notice, I kind of like cut you off a little bit just to kind of get through all the points that we wanted to get through.
Yeah.
And I think some of the spaces where we took a little bit of extra time was kind of history and physical. Now, all the things you asked for were relevant, but you kind of got to be concise in your mind about what you really need to know and what you don't want to, because you can easily spend a couple minutes just kind of asking those questions off the bat. So if it's really important, I think it's okay to ask, but also just kind of have in your mind, do I really need to know this? Do I not? And all those things. You said you were going to do kind of a quick history and physical and went into all these history questions and then jumped right into imaging and never actually went back to like kind of what you wanted to do with the physical exam.
Uh-huh.
And I think those things are kind of easy to do. Same thing with like labs. A lot of times you get an idea of what the scenario is and what the examiner is trying to get to. and you like jump right in. You're like, I know this, I can nail it, and you kind of skip a few steps. I think upper GI is a great way to start. You know, some people would even start with an EGD at first. I don't think either one's wrong, but I agree you want to do both of those at minimum. So upper GI kind of gave you a good idea of what was going on. The EGD is important. As you mentioned, you want to rule out any masses or anything like that. I think getting preoperative clearance is important. You kind of, again, spent a little bit extra time on that. You could just say, you know, I'd make sure that they were prepared for the operating room.
Right.
Have them see anesthesia for a preoperative assessment and kind of move along from there. You know, other things you can kind of, you know, may want to consider in the workup would be, you know, EKG or chest x-ray, stress test. I mean, we kind of had an idea exactly what was going on.
Yeah.
But if somebody maybe comes in with more acute pain, you want to rule out some of those other causes of epigastric pain.
Right.
As far as the repair, you know, these are kind of, when they ask you to describe the repairs, that's a part that can either, you can spend a lot of time or you can be a little more brief on. It's easy to spend a lot of time. And again, that's a time where you can chew up a lot of the available time for that scenario. So I think, you know, the key points are you want to identify the crus, you want to reduce the whole hernia, reduce the sac, which you got to, you want to mobilize the esophagus. You said you want to get, like, adequate length of intra-abdominal esophagus. You know, most people just kind of throw out a number and say, I would get, you know, make sure I had 4 centimeters adequate esophageal length. You, a couple times I caught yourself, and you caught yourself, too, saying, like, you could or
yeah.
You know, you could maybe do this. And you caught yourself a few times, but, again, this is where practicing for the boards is really good because it gets you into the pattern of saying, just kind of say, I would do this. I want to know this. This is what I would do and go from there. You said you'd use absorbable sutures to close the crus. Most people, I think everybody I know, always uses permanent sutures because otherwise they're just going to go away. So permanent sutures to close your crus. A bougie is appropriate. You know, most people would use a 54, 56 French, kind of depending on what set that you have. If it's a 65-year-old female, so a smaller one may be okay, but just kind of have a number. You started by saying I would use a large bougie, and then you kind of went back and threw a number. And so just kind of have one and say I would use this. You're right. You said you'd do a Nissen, which I think most people would agree upon. But I think in this day and age, a high-resolution manometry will give you some information, especially in a lady who's 65 years old. She kind of had some additional vague symptoms, some dysphagia as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you worry a little bit about what her esophageal function is going to be like. And so if she has some limited esophageal function, she may not be able to tolerate, you know, a 360-degree wrap. And the Nissen can, or I'm sorry, and the high-resolution manometry can give you a little bit more information on all those things.
Right.
As far as the post-operative management, you know, so I think before we jump into that, there is no, like, right answer for all these things. You know, what the board and the examiners really want you to do is kind of be able to give your thought process and your rationalization for why you're going to do all these things. So just because you say, I would use a 54 French bougie and somebody else says I'd use a 56 French bougie, doesn't mean kind of one person's going to fail or not, but kind of have an idea as to why you're doing all those things. So as far as the post-op management, you know, I had a couple curveballs to throw at you. We only kind of got to one. You know, there's mixed feelings as far as routine imaging on post-op day one. I think most people, if it was a straightforward para Nissen and no real concerns or anything like that and a primary repair, I think it's okay to skip getting the esophagram and just kind of start them on clears and see how they do. If they tolerate clears, I think you're planned for liquids for a week and then kind of soft diet. I think that's totally reasonable. You know, so when people come on post-op day one and they don't get anything through, you know, a lot of times it can just be some edema. And I think, you know, depending on how severe their symptoms are, if they say, well, I tried to drink a bunch and, you know, I felt like it was getting stuck still, I said, you know, you can kind of write that off. If it's somebody who says, listen, I can't even keep my saliva down, a lot of people would consider getting an esophagram the same day. I think waiting a second day is not the end of the world. So you get your esophagram the next day. And I think if nothing goes through post-op day number two, you know, in my experience, I think a lot of the people who do a ton of foregut stuff would consider even potentially kind of starting the discussion of going back to the operating room sooner rather than later. So your ultimate goal of waiting kind of 1 to 2 weeks and going back, you know, all of a sudden you're at 2 weeks going back in a redo esophagus to say your balloon dilation doesn't work or anything like that. then you're trying to re-op at kind of the worst time possible. So usually, you know, again, it's not to say one approach is right or wrong, but if you're in 2 days or 3 days and nothing's going through and they're still, like, having severe symptoms, I think it's reasonable to consider going back to the operating room.
Okay.
All in all, I guess just a couple other, you know, other style points as we talked about, you know, just kind of just commit to it. I would do this. I would do that. And I think, you know, one of the things is we talked about last week, if you run into something, you're like, oh man, I really wish I would have had manometry before I did my Nissen.
Yeah.
You know, just throw it in there. Be like, oh, you know, I forgot. I definitely would want to get high resolution manometry before we went to the operating room, to help me make sure it's safe to do a full wrap or anything like that. And I think they will still give you credit
okay.
if you kind of catch yourself and go back and justify it. So just commit to kind of what you want to do. So for the second case, you know, we are a little more focused. We kind of got through all the, a few of the more different kind of scenarios and switched things up. You're spot on, 22-year-old young female, pretty classic presentation, but you definitely want to rule out kind of all those other causes, especially in a female. You know, gynecologic kind of things. I think most people would recommend doing a pelvic exam at the same time. So when you do your abdominal exam, especially in somebody like this, just rule out, get a gynecologic exam. Your labs, I think, were spot on. You know, chemistry, basic. UA and pregnancy tests are both very important as looking forward. Imaging, I think that's correct. You know, in this day and age, in a 22-year-old female, it'd be pretty rare not to get a CT scan. Some people may argue, on a 22-year-old male with a classic story that, you know, you can just proceed with a lap-appy. But mm-hmm. in general, I think for the boards, I don't think you're wrong to get a CAT scan, and it's probably the right thing to do, especially in a female where you're trying to rule out other things. Family history, you kind of covered. That's good. Then you said you give them a dose of antibiotics. I think that's perfect. You know, those are the little style points that a lot of people kind of pass over. So, you know, I say I give them a dose of antibiotics on the way to the operating room. The other thing that, you know, a good quick style point is when you say, like, I would go to the operating room for a lap appy. You could just kind of change your tone and say, I would discuss with the patient and consent them for a lap appy. You know, and that shows that, you know, as a surgeon, you're kind of thinking about all those other things. It doesn't really take much more time. And it's not like I can't imagine they would fail you for not saying that. But they're just kind of style points that makes it think that, you know, you really have an idea of what you're going to do on your way through. As far as antibiotics, you gave a few different scenarios. You're like, well, you could give this or this or this, and that's fine. But for the boards, just pick one and say, I would give a dose of this on the way to the operating room, whatever you want.
Okay.
Your technique, I think, was fine. You know, Hassan, I think, is totally fine. Foley catheter, I think, is totally fine. So I think, you know, all those setup things were okay. As far as non-operative management, I think, your counseling was totally correct, you know, and you just kind of want to have a discussion with the patient. You kind of told them what the risks were and all those different things if I really wanted to push it. And so you will get kind of an ethical question. You could, you know, they could kind of push it a little bit more, and then you'd have to have kind of a more discussion as far as, you know, they don't want to have surgery and they're getting worse and what would you do and stuff like that. So always kind of have that in the back of your mind that there may be some kind of ethical challenge that they're trying to get you to address. But I think your management of that was fine. For the person with the perforated appendicitis, I agree, most people would give IV antibiotics, perc drain, and an interval appy. Again, you know, there's some data that shows that you could skip on the interval appy, but I think most people would recommend it. And then you're right, at 50 years old, you want to rule out a malignancy, so colonoscopy is important. You know, acute coli, you can kind of go to the operating room, but just make sure they get a colonoscopy at a later point. If they kind of have some vague symptoms, more like almost a chronic cholecystitis kind of picture, you definitely want to get the colonoscopy before you head to the operating room. You know, different ways they could spin it. There could be an appendiceal malignancy. They could find some evidence of Crohn's disease. It could be necrotic down to the base. You can't get a good staple load. So those are all different ways that the questions kind of be spun to cover different things. So, you know, I think in general, you kind of hit on all the key points. I don't think you made any critical flaws in either case. You know, definitely, everybody can have some style points just to make it run a little bit smoother, you know, just kind of commit to what you want to do and go with it. But overall, I think, you know, you did a good job.
So I can go.
You guys have.
I can go drink now, right?
I think so. Somebody's got to take care of the patients tomorrow.
So. No, that was good. That was very helpful. Yeah, Thank you. That was awesome. Tips. Awesome. Okay. So I think it's Kevin's turn now.
It's me.
All right. Okay. Jason, anything else before we move on?
No, I don't. I don't think so. I think those were all. I mean, the feedback was spot on. I think it's all very useful. Those were good scenarios.
Yeah, I'm jealous. Yeah, you got the appy scenario.
Yeah, it's especially when it's something you don't like. You know, when it's something you're not doing every day. Like, you know, I don't do esophageal hernias every day. Just going back and remembering to take a breath and think, and yeah, okay, things like manometry and how you close a cruce and things like that. It's important just to take a step back and take a deep breath and think through it, because it's not something that comes second nature.
Yeah, one thing you did on the second case, I just saw in my notes, you did kind of like repeat the whole scenario I gave you again, which, I don't think it's wrong to do. It may kind of like frustrate some of the examiners some. You know, a lot of people do that as a method to just kind of, take that break and collect their thoughts and all that stuff. You can even kind of just do that in your head a little bit for just, 5 seconds and jump in. Some people may get, upset. I don't think it's like a failure or anything to repeat the scenario back, but it looks like it's an obvious stall technique that is pretty blatant when people do it, and so people catch on that, as opposed to just kind of taking 10 seconds in your head and be like, okay, this is what I want to do, and just go for it. And again, for all the scenarios, if you kind of have a generalized plan, history, physical, labs, imaging, complete your workup, operating room, post-op management, and if you just kind of have that in your mind for everything, whether it's a breast cancer or a neck mass or a thyroid, it'll keep you from doing those mistakes of where you jump ahead before you kind of have done the workup for everything.
So. Great.
All right, now come all the hard ones. Those are the easy ones. Kevin, you can get the hard ones.
I'm the junior resident. That's not fair.
That's all right. Everything's hard. Okay, you ready?
Yes, sir.
So your first scenario is a 48-year-old male who was driving home from work who was T-boned on the driver's side by another driver who ran the red light. The ambulance EMS reports that initially in the field his vital signs were heart rate of 92, blood pressure of 105 over 78, and respiratory rate of 18. During transport, he's received 1 liter of IV fluids, and when he arrives in the trauma bay, his heart rate's now 108. His blood pressure is 99 over 65, and his respiratory rate is 24.
Okay, I would proceed with my ABCDs of trauma. So I would inspect his airway. Is his airway patent? Is he talking to me? Hey, hey, Mr. Jones, how are you doing? Does he respond to that?
Yeah, he's able to talk. He's kind of mumbling some random things. They're not making a lot of sense, but he can communicate with you.
Okay, and then I'll listen for bilateral breath sounds.
So he's got breath sounds bilaterally. They're a little bit diminished on the left, but he's got breath sounds bilaterally.
Okay. I will go ahead and make sure all the cardiac monitor and blood pressure cuffs are getting on him and feel for a pulse at this point.
He's got a pulse.
Okay. I will then do a pupillary exam on him and see if he can move his extremities for me.
So he's kind of able to localize to pain when you're kind of pushing on stuff, and he opens his eyes to command. His pupils are responsive to light.
Okay. I would then, do I have my vital signs yet in the ER?
So he's on the monitors. His heart rate's now 112. His blood pressure is essentially the same, high 90s over 60s, and his respiratory rate's still 24.
And I'm sorry, part of my C was to establish access. I'd get 2 large bore IVs in each antecubital fossa. Are we able to establish IV access? So
you have a really good nurse in there with you. She's able to get 2 IVs in.
Okay. At this point, I would proceed with a chest x-ray and place a Foley catheter.
Okay. You get your... Go ahead.
No, that's it.
You get your chest x-ray. It does show a moderate-sized left hemothorax. You go to put your Foley catheter in, and you have some difficulty getting it to pass.
Okay. I would stop attempting the Foley. I would, at this point, proceed with my secondary survey and have my resident get set up for a chest tube. And at this time, I'd also perform a fast exam.
Okay. So you do your fast exam. It's positive. What areas do you look for in your fast exam?
So I look above the liver. I'm sorry, between the liver and the kidney. Between, I look at the spleen, and I look above the bladder, and I would look at a pericardial window also.
So you, on your fast scan, he does have a small amount of fluid in the left gutter on fast exam. The rest of your secondary survey is significant for a mildly distended abdomen, and otherwise no other acute gross abnormalities.
And at this time, I would also... I would send off my trauma labs, which include a cross and type, I would, you know, activate the transfusion protocol, given that I have a hypotensive patient with fluid in his abdomen.
Okay. What other labs would you send off?
I would send a CBC, BMP, COAGs, and the cross and type, and those would be the most pertinent right now.
Okay. So your other resident puts the left chest tube in that you'd asked for. It gives back about 300 cc's of blood, and your fast scan's still positive. What would you like to do next?
I would go and just reassess my AB, C, and D at this point. His airway, is his airway still intact?
Yeah, his airway is still intact. He's still breathing. You know, no other signs of extra bleeding or anything like this. On vital signs now, his heart rate's 120, mm-hmm. And his blood pressure is 92 over 60.
Okay. And I would check for breath sounds, and I would start the first unit of blood at this point.
Okay.
You start
hanging your first unit of blood. His heart rate starts to come down a little bit. It's now about 110. His blood pressure after the first unit's done is now about the low hundreds over 70.
Okay, and I meant to send a lactate at the time of labs. Is CBC and lactate back at this point?
Yeah, so his CBC's back. It's pretty much unremarkable. His white count's 11. His H&H is 10 and 38. And his lactate is 2.
His lactate's 2. And I'm sorry, could you repeat his current vital signs one more time?
So his heart rate's about 112 right now. His blood pressure was low hundreds over 70s, and his respiratory rate's about 22.
Okay. I think at this point I feel comfortable enough taking him to the CT scanner to do a CT of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis with IV contrast.
Anything else that you would do while you're in the CAT scanner, or just the chest, abdomen, and pelvis?
His head also. I would scan his head.
Okay. All right. So you get your CT scan, and it shows a grade 4 grade 4 splenic laceration with active extravasation.
Okay. How about his head and chest?
The chest shows your chest tube in place. He does have some contusions and some small amount of undrained hematoma on the left. The right side is relatively unremarkable. He also has a couple left-sided rib fractures. His head is negative.
Okay. At this point, I would discuss with his family that he has a ruptured spleen and that we need to go to the operating room to perform a splenectomy. And I would take him emergently to the operating room, and I would ensure that 4 units of blood that he was crossed in type 4 were in the operating room with us.
Okay, and what's your plan in the operating room?
Okay, in the operating room, I'm going to perform a midline laparotomy, and I'm going to... essentially pack all 4 quadrants, and then I will do a sequential exam of the abdomen, likely starting with the right lower quadrant as it's the furthest from where I suspect any problems, and then eventually working my way to the left upper quadrant, and where I imagine I'll find a ruptured spleen, and I would mobilize the spleen bluntly with my hand. A lot of times these spleens have been mobilized by the trauma, and I would just perform a staple load across the hilum and get the spleen out and complete my abdominal exam, intra-abdominal exam, and close him up, assuming he's stable at this point.
Okay. Let's go back a little bit. So you get he's still stable in the trauma bay. You go to the CAT scanner, and it instead of showing the grade 4 with the active extravasation, it shows a grade 3 splenic injury with a small amount of peri-splenic fluid.
Okay.
He's now stable after his one unit of blood.
Okay. The one thing I did forget to ask for was ample for his allergies, medications, past medical history, and surgical history. Is there anything pertinent in those?
No.
Okay. So now he has, you said there was active extravasation? Grade 3?
No, the first time through, the current one, he does not have no active extravasation.
No active extravasation, and he's stable. At this point, I would, what did his coags come back at? Are they normal?
They're normal.
Okay. I would discuss with his family the risk and benefits of non-operative management of a splenic injury and offer them a trial of non-operative management in the ICU.
Okay. They think that sounds good. What's kind of your plan for him?
So I would put him in the ICU, with full monitoring. I would make sure blood is available. I would check Q2-hour crits for the first 6 hours and perform serial abdominal exams just see how he does.
Okay. All right, let's go back a little bit. So now it's your first gentleman. You took him to the operating room. You did a splenectomy. He did okay. He was unstable coming out of the operating room, so he elected to leave his abdomen packed. He went back to the operating room the next day, kind of washed him out. Everything looked okay. He returned to the intensive care unit. And while you're in the intensive care unit over the next 24 hours, he developed some oliguria, critical care. And a team tells you that they're having some more trouble ventilating him, and his abdomen is big and distended.
Okay. At this point, his abdomen has been closed, and he is showing signs of abdominal compartment syndrome. I would confirm this with a Foley catheter with bladder pressure, but I would be heading to the OR as we were doing that, as he needs to have his abdomen opened and decompressed.
Okay. What would you do? How would you do that? What would you do after you open his abdomen?
I would open his abdomen. I would explore to make sure we don't have any continued active bleeding. And then I would place a temporary abdominal closure on his abdomen and bring him back to the ICU.
Your next case is a 71-year-old female with a history of coronary artery disease and diabetes who presents to the emergency department with acute onset of abdominal pain. She reports that it started about 6 hours ago. She's never had anything like this in the past, and she reports that it just hurts everywhere.
Okay, so I would start with a history. I'm concerned for a perforated viscus of some sort, so I'd want to know if she smokes, if she has a history of H. pylori, if she uses NSAIDs, if she's on omeprazole chronically, and then if she has any history of any abdominal surgeries, and if she's had her screening colonoscopies.
So she does not smoke. She doesn't know what H. pylori is. She's never heard of it before. She takes some ibuprofen rarely. The only surgery she's had was a hysterectomy for benign fibroids. And her last colonoscopy was 5 years ago, and it was negative.
Okay. At this point, I'll proceed with a physical exam, focusing on the abdomen. Is her abdomen peritoneal?
She's incredibly uncomfortable. She's moderately distended. She's got diffuse tenderness everywhere, with some mild voluntary guarding.
Okay. What are her vital signs at this point?
So her heart rate's 122. Her blood pressure is 105 over 72. Respiratory rate is 20. That's okay. What the nurse gives you.
Okay. So at this point, I will send off labs. I'll send off a CBC, a BMP, hepatic panel, and coags. And I will get a plain film abdominal x-ray at this point.
Okay, so you send off all those things. Her white blood cell count comes back at 14. On her chemistry, her creatinine's 1.5. Her coags are unremarkable. And her plain film doesn't really show you anything too exciting.
And a lactate also?
Her lactate is 3.
Her lactate is 3. Okay, so I'll begin resuscitation with fluids, and I would... take her to the CT scanner for a CT of her abdomen with IV contrast.
Okay, so you get your CT scan. It shows a specific segment of thickened bowel with some findings of pneumatosis within it. There's a small amount of free fluid in her pelvis as well as some surrounding edema of the sloop of bowel.
Okay, so and so it appears she has a small bowel obstruction with some pneumatosis. So at this point, I would place an NG tube. I would start her on broad spectrum antibiotics. I would place her on Zosyn, and then given that she has pneumatosis and a elevated lactate, I would discuss the risks and benefits of a laparoscopic exploration, likely converting to a laparotomy with the patient, and bring her to the operating room for this.
All right. And what are you going to the what are you expecting to find?
I'm concerned that she has necrotic bowel.
Okay. So you go to the operating room, you put your laparoscope in. How are you going to gain access in her?
I would do a Hassan entry at the umbilicus, a supra-umbilical Hassan.
So you put your camera in, you see an isolated segment of small bowel that looks frankly ischemic. It's probably about 20 centimeters or so. The rest of the small bowel looks the surrounding small bowel looks a little dusky. As well.
Okay.
What would you like to do now?
At this point in time, I would convert to a laparotomy and do a full exploration of her abdomen and run her bowel from the LOT to the ileocecal valve.
Okay. So you you convert to a midline laparotomy. You run the rest of her small bowel. You don't really appreciate any other gross abnormalities. She's got very minimal adhesions. Just kind of one loop of small bowel that was stuck down in her pelvis, but does not seem to be the source of her ischemia.
Okay, I would ask anesthesia what her heart rhythm is at this point in time.
All right, so on the monitor in the operating room, it does look like she's in AFib.
She's in AFib. Okay. So I am concerned that she... had embolic mesenteric ischemia, so I would resect the frankly necrotic piece of bowel. I would then put a temporary abdominal closure, and I would bring her to the ICU and resuscitate her.
Okay. So you do all those things. You resect the frankly necrotic stuff. You put your temporary abdominal closure on. She's now in the ICU. What would you like to do there?
I would just like to keep her on antibiotics. I would anticoagulate her and I with heparin, and I would plan on taking her back to the OR at 24 hours to re-explore her abdomen.
Okay. So you go back at 24 hours. Nothing else looks frankly ischemic other than the area or beyond what you had already resected. The rest looks pretty stable. What else would you like to do in the operating room?
So at this point, I would... is she overall physiologically resuscitated, or is her vitals relatively normal?
Her vital signs have significantly improved. Her heart rate's now in the low hundreds. She's back into sinus rhythm. Her lactate is normalized, and her creatinine is hovering right around 2.
Okay. At this point in time, I would plan on doing putting her small bowel together, re-anastomosing, and I would keep the NG tube in, and I would close her abdomen, and I would keep her in the ICU after this.
Okay, so you go back to the ICU, you do all those things. That's post-op day number 4. She becomes hypotensive and tachycardic. Heart rate's now in the 120s, and her blood pressure's in the 80s over 60s.
So post-op day 4, what is her physical exam at this point in time?
She's still intubated. Her abdomen's moderately distended, but not terribly so. She's just on minimal sedation, so she has some discomfort to palpation in the midline, but no other really gross abnormalities.
Okay, and is she having any desaturations or changes in her ABG?
From a saturation standpoint, no. Her sats are hovering okay. She's on 40% FiO2. Her PaO2 is appropriate.
Her PaO2 is appropriate. At this point in time, I would perform a CT scan of her chest to rule out a PE, and I would get an EKG, but I would also perform a CT of her abdomen at the same time as the chest.
Okay. What are you looking for on the CT of the abdomen and pelvis?
The abdomen and pelvis, I'm looking for any further signs of ischemic bowel or bleeding are my two main concerns.
Okay. How do you think you did?
I think I did okay. I'm not sure if I finished that last scenario off the way it was supposed to go, but I'm curious to find out.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the takeaway to that statement is, like, there is no way it's supposed to go. I mean, so a lot of it is kind of, you know, scripted, I guess. I don't know if it's scripted, but there, you know, there's certain things I'm sure they want to cover. Again, I've never given the board, so I don't know for sure, but just in kind of my experience, you know, there are certain things that they want to cover, but it doesn't necessarily mean it has to go a certain way. They have some creative liberty, the examiners do, in how they give the test. So they may, you know, decide to go one way for you, and you ask somebody else, and they're like, well, I had a similar scenario, but they went this way, and you're like, oh, no, then I really screwed up. So I wouldn't necessarily try to read into it. Also, you don't want to take the test trying to figure out where the examiners are trying to go. Like, you kind of just want to just roll with it and kind of figure things out. So I think, let's go back to the first scenario. So traumas, I think everything was right. You know, trauma is kind of like a freebie. It gives you that time to kind of think by just saying, well, I'm going to do my ABCs, I'm going to start 2 large bore IVs, I'm going to start IV fluids, which you never gave a second liter fluid, and kind of do all those things. I think chest x-ray is totally right. You know, a lot of people include that in the primary survey. You know, a Foley catheter, you know, I could have really gone off target with that a little bit. That wasn't really where I wanted to go. But I think most people after blunt trauma like this would probably get a pelvis x-ray or look for blood at the meatus or something like that before they try to put a Foley in, just in case there's any kind of ureteral disruption. I gave you a little bit of a hard time about it, but I didn't really want to go that way, so I didn't really keep going You know, at labs, you eventually came back and said you'd get some labs, but I would just make that as part of your ABCs. You know, say right. when you get, I'm going to have them put in two large bore IVs. At the same time, I'll have them draw bloods for a type and cross for, you know, however many units, CBC, coags. Lactate, I think, is fine. Some people may send an ABG just to kind of give you a baseline. Some people may add a drug screen at that point, again, kind of get you baseline. Those are kind of bonus points, but nothing too out of control. You know, checking pulses, I think, is good. You just said I would feel for a pulse. You know, what I think you maybe meant to do is, you know, I'd check for pulses in all four extremities or something like that. You kind of just said, like, I would feel for a pulse, which is kind of a little vague as far as what you want to do. You know, you got your chest x-ray, showed your hemothorax. You said you're going to set up for a chest tube. I think that's good. You went into your secondary survey, which was good. You know, pelvis x-ray, maybe it's alongside the chest x-ray. I think you'd get those at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, fast scan, I think, is appropriate in blood trauma. You know, and then some people would, you know, in this day and age with all the management, you know, of non-operative management of trauma, I think if the fast scan, even if that's positive and they're overall stable, most people would go to the CAT scanner like you did. And I kind of made him stabilize out a little bit after you gave him a unit of blood. So you could go to the CAT scanner. So I think that's fine. You know, some people may tell you he's unstable. I kind of had a thing to put, you know, he decompensates in the CAT scanner on the way to the CAT scanner.
I was afraid of that.
Like that. As far as going to the operating room, I think your approach was fine. Midline laparotomy is generally correct. No, you didn't initially say a head CT, but I think most people would get a head CT there. I kind of gave you a GCS of like 10 as far as kind of the things like that. So that's at least, you know, after a significant blunt trauma, I think most people include a CT scan of the head at that time.
Definitely.
You know, packing all four quadrants is fine. Sequential exam of them all is fine. Staple load, or you can tie off the hilum. I think either one is totally fine for kind of management there. As far as the, you know, grade 3 splenic injury stable, I think non-operative management is correct. You go to the ICU, you watch them, you get serial H&Hs and abdominal exams. I think all those things are fine. You know, the abdominal compartment syndrome was kind of one of the things that I wanted to go into. I think, you know, checking a bladder pressure at least gives you a number. They may ask you how do you do that, just kind of know how to do a compartment syndrome. Do you know how to do that?
How to check for a bladder pressure?
Specifically? How to measure it?
No, I've personally, I've never checked that. I mean, other than asking the nurses to check one.
Yeah, you put a Foley in, you instill, I can't remember the number that you instill, but somewhere in the ballpark of 100 mLs, and then you can hook it up to a transducer. I think the same transducer that you can, you know, read like a CVP or an A-line pressure off of, that can give you a pressure.
Yep. Yeah. So yeah, you know, whether you put 100 or 60 or 150, it doesn't matter. Essentially what you want is a kind of a continuous, fluid, volume within the bladder to give you a number. You just want to make sure you clamp the beyond the little accessory port, and you're right. You can just hook up a standard A-line or CVP hookup and get that. So yeah, you can check your bladder pressures. You know, you want to check for respiratory decompensation, decrease urine output, end stage kind of organ dysfunction. Going to the operating room is fine. You know, other options is you can kind of spin it and make it unstable, or you've got a head injury and a bolt and you can't go, you know, that neurosurgery doesn't want you to go back to the OR, do something like that. You know, then you can always open it at the bedside. If we had time, I was going to go into some ARDS stuff and management there, but we spent 10 minutes on that scenario as it was. So, I mean, when you kind of look at it this way, you know, the real boards is, you know, that's 3 minutes longer than a normal board scenario than you kind of have.
Mm-hmm.
It's real fast. And obviously the examiners are much better at it than I am, so they're much more efficient at moving things through than obviously I would be. But in general, it goes pretty fast.
Definitely.
For the second scenario, for you, Kevin, you know, it was mesenteric ischemia, kind of pushing that way from the beginning. I think, you know, your differential is fine. You know, smoking H. pylori NSAIDs, you know, you kind of thought perfiscus right away, which is not inappropriate. Abdominal exam is appropriate. Most people would add a rectal exam at that point, just to kind of rule out anything gross or blood or anything like that. EKG would have been helpful.
Yeah, that would have been very helpful.
It would have given you AFib right away. Well, at least it would have given you kind of, would have pushed you into that direction. I think your labs were all okay. Amylase and lipase, maybe, if you're concerned for, you know, it could be pancreatitis or something like that. Lactate was fine. I think I gave you the creatinine was 1.5. You gave IV contrast with the CT, kind of borderline. If you notice that her creatinine stayed elevated later on, again, I don't think that's like fail-worthy stuff, but just kind of be in tune to some of those little nuances. You know, those things can add up. If they were to give you the creatinine was 3 and you gave them IV contrast,
right?
You know, they can kind of pile those things on. In the OR, I think, you know, your idea was fine. And diagnostic laparoscopy, I don't think that's wrong. Just kind of have a low index of suspicion that you may end up with a laparotomy. I think where a lot of people would recommend against doing a diagnostic laparoscopy, this one wasn't a specific small bowel obstruction, in that it was just a small segment of thickened bowel, yeah, pneumatosis. So I was really kind of trying to get towards ischemic bowel. But if they have a bunch of dilated loops and a big, huge fluid-filled stomach, you know, you worry a little bit about going into that laparoscopically. And if their belly is distended, you know, how much actual visualization you're going to get to even make it worthwhile to do a diagnostic laparoscopy other than just kind of spending an extra 20 minutes. So just kind of have that in tune. I think in this scenario, it's not necessarily wrong, but just kind of have that in mind.
Right.
NG tube is fine. You gave broad-spectrum antibiotics. Some Zosyn, I think that's okay. Other things we could have thrown out, or from what you did, resecting the deck portion is correct. Leave anything that's borderline, plan a second look, I think is the safe thing to do in this scenario. You eventually kind of caught on and went back and asked what the heart rate was on the monitor in the operating room. That's okay. You know, in the OR, people can ask how you would assess the remainder of the bowel if you're uncertain. You know, you can do a floor scene and a Woods lamp. Those can be incredibly hard to find in most operating rooms these days. You can do a Doppler on the anti-mesenteric border. You always want to also just kind of assess the SMA. So even if you just kind of feel for it at the base of the transverse colon, you want to at least try to feel and make sure that there's still a pulse in it. That would be probably more important if it was like diffusely ischemic as opposed to just kind of one isolated segment.
Right.
But have that in mind. As far as the post-operative management, and you will likely have one of these scenarios, somebody's going to kind of decompensate on post-op day, you know, 3, 4, something like that. And I think at that point in time, what you want to do is go back and rule out all of your causes of shock. So just kind of pause and think, okay, what are the likely things in this patient? Hypovolemic, sure, it could be bleeding. You have them on anticoagulation. You know, septic shock, you know, again, did a bowel resection and anastomosis, could have, you know, intra-abdominal infection. Cardiogenic, we know that she's 71, she's AFib, she's got coronary artery disease, diabetes, you got an EKG, you know, could add troponins to that. You know, neurogenic, unlikely in this person. You know, check labs as well as with your EKG. Always look at your wound, make sure your wound's okay. You said you'd do an exam, I think that's fine. You know, you could spin it as neck fash, you could spin it as, you know, an intracutaneous fistula, you could spin it a lot of different ways. CT scan of the chest, I think that's fine if your index of suspicion is high enough. I didn't really have committed to anything in my notes as far as which way I wanted this to go, you know, whether it was a heart attack or an MI, you know, an MI or something like that, but just kind of pause and think of all the different scenarios that it could be. You can even kind of in your head, just go back to the ABCs, you know, is she still intubated? How is her breathing? You know, you could do any kind of things out of these post-operative complications. CT abdomen pelvis on post-op day 4, I don't think that's wrong if you're uncertain. You know, probably anything less than that is not going to be overly helpful because you're going to see some free fluid. You're going to see maybe some free air. So, I mean, kind of have an idea. I think before you order any test, whether it's in real life or the boards, always have in the back of your mind how those results are going to change your management. You know, are you going to do something different with that result? Or if you get something, are you just going to, like, continue on the course regardless of what that test shows?
Right.
So I think all those things are okay. And, again, don't try to, like, anticipate where the examiners are going because they may just change it up on you if you get kind of too far ahead of yourself. We spent 9 minutes on that scenario, so not terrible, not too bad. But again, in real life, we're a little bit slow. Again, some of that's my fault just as much as, you know, kind of just getting into a pattern of what you want to do, what you want to say efficiently. But I don't think for either of these, in my mind, again, I don't know the true scoring algorithm for these, but I don't think either of you made kind of critical flaws that would result in a fail for either of these.
Phew. Well, sir, I found that extremely helpful, and I've learned a ton just producing this episode. And
yeah, hopefully our listeners can benefit from listening to us struggle through this, if nothing more than entertaining for them.
Yeah, and if we do any more of these, we might have to get some random listeners in on it to get oral boards by Dr. Blatnick, so they don't have to keep hearing us screw up. But Dr. Blatnick, thank you so much for taking us through this, and I hope we can do some more of these because I think this will be extremely popular.
Yeah, that was awesome. We would love to do more of these in the future.
Sure thing. Happy to be part of it. Thanks, guys.
Until next time, dominate the day.